You're listening to a conversation with Joe Strauss, part of the Texas Tribune's Trib Live event series. The event was made possible by the generosity of our sponsors, AT&T and IBC Bank.
Let me now introduce our distinguished guest. It was exactly 1 year ago today, about a week after the Tarrytown takeover or the Herman Brown hijack or whatever you want to call it, that Joe Strauss was chosen by his peers to be the 75th Speaker of the Texas House. He was first elected in February of 2005 in a special election to represent District 121 in San Antonio, and he seems well on his way, safely on his way, to being elected to a third full term as he has no Democratic opponent on the ballot. We're very honored and lucky to have him for our first conversation to talk about the state of the state and the state of the speakership and what happens next. Please join me in welcoming the Honorable Joe Strauss. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good morning, and thank you for being here.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Appreciate your being here. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff, past, present, and future, but I want to start with the news of late yesterday. Perhaps you can tell a crowd that will be intensely interested what happened with Clyde. You announced that Clyde Alexander, your chief of staff for the last year, would be stepping down, become a senior advisor, and that Denise Davis, the House parliamentarian, would take his place. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah. Clyde is here. Denise is here this morning. Clyde is my dear friend from San Antonio. And it was a year ago today that he very generously volunteered a year of his life to service to the state. And I'm very, very grateful for the sacrifice that he's made in the past year. But he has a beautiful place in New Mexico that he wasn't able to spend very much time enjoying in the past year. So I think we just decided that he will continue on in service to me in a different capacity as a senior advisor. Someone who's, Clyde's been a mentor to me and, as I said, a very dear personal friend and a neighbor from San Antonio. So I think having given a year back to the House, an institution that he served in very honorably for 14 years and now 15 years in a different capacity, it's time for Clyde to enjoy his life a little bit more, continue to give me good advice as he has. Mm-hmm. And we have made a pretty seamless transition on the second floor, asking our very able and brilliant lawyer, Denise Davis, who served as House parliamentarian, to fill in Clyde's position. So I'm delighted at the ease of that transition. And again, very, very grateful to Clyde for giving one more year to his state.
No choice yet on the new parliamentarian?
No.
Terry Keel?
Well,
Ron Wilson, possibly. Do you have? Are you going to rule anybody out as well as ruling people in?
No, I really haven't. I haven't really gotten to that decision yet. I know there are a number of people that are under consideration, but I don't think there's any rush in filling that spot.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the year. So it was 1 year ago, as we said. Happy anniversary, being in the job. Is there a point at which, in the last year or today, maybe in fact at this very moment, you go back and you think about that night on Polo Road and you wish somebody else's name had been pulled out of the Harry Potter sorting hat? Not yours, but somebody else's?
Well, there are times maybe we should have considered having a bigger hat to pull the names from. No, never. It was a real surprise to me, as I've told people before. Until I arrived at that meeting, I hadn't really arrived at the conclusion that I should put my name into consideration. Right. I hadn't filled out the papers to run for speaker until I got to the meeting and we had discussed the rules under which we were going to choose one of the 11 who were there and participating. And as it turned out, I think it was 8 of the 11 put our names in, and when they got to me, I paused and I swallowed hard, and I thought maybe they'd think less of me if I said no and declined. So I said, sure, I'm in, and as it turned out, I was the compromise choice. But I think any one of us could have done the job and done it well.
But of course it was you, and so the question I asked to you having taken the job is, do you have any regrets over the last year? Were there times in which you thought, you know, this is not the job I expected it to be, or it's not the job I wished it had been?
No, not really. First of all, I never really expected to have the job.
Well, maybe no expectations. So there were no.
Yeah, there were no expectations, right. And it was. And it's been an incredible honor to have this responsibility. And I haven't had a lot of time to reflect. Really, it's kind of people have to remind me that today is the 1 year anniversary of our of our session. It's been, every day has been a learning experience for me. I think we've done very well under the circumstances, and I have no regrets, just a lot of gratitude that the members have placed their faith in me.
Now, to some degree, the course of your speakership was set almost before you got in the job and almost before you banged the gavel on that first day when the decision of the Senate came down to make voter ID, if not a big issue, maybe even the big issue of the year. As you look back on the emphasis that the House and the Senate put, but for your purposes, let's talk about the House, on voter ID over the course of the spring, do you wish now, in retrospect, that that had been different, that you had decided not to steer the course the way that you did?
Well, a lot of that was out of my control, as you said. The House doesn't control the Senate's agenda or pace of work, and the House doesn't control the Senate. The Senate doesn't control the House. But we do what we do. We had some challenges in the House this past session, at a 76-74, very closely divided House. Any issue that had the potential to become incendiary, as voter ID was, I knew had the potential to cause problems. And so being deliberate and trying to work things out, which is typically my style anyway, I have no regrets that that's how we tried to work at it. Todd Smith, who chairs the Elections Committee, worked his heart out trying to find an accommodation, trying to find enough votes to where we could actually pass something and then work out the details with the Senate. When it became late in the session, there was a lot of pressure that we had to deal with that issue. I have no regrets that we dealt with it the way we did. I certainly didn't anticipate that there would be a 5-day chubathon, but they acted within the rules, and as it turns out, I was very proud of the way the House, both sides, kept our wits about us and just went through our business. There were certain ramifications of those decisions that were plus and minus on, regardless of where you sat in the House. A lot of people saw their favorite bills not come up for a vote, but that's Republicans and Democrats. So I have no regrets about the way we conducted our affairs with that very volatile issue. And I think, as it turned out, the session was a great success in spite of that one.
Well, I'm inclined to ask about that because you know one looks at the way that the arc of the narrative of the session, and you know Paul Burka and Patty Hart in Texas Monthly at the end of the session referred to it as the Seinfeld session, a session about nothing. And the reality is that the work product of the House at the end was much less than it might have been, probably much less than you wished it had been. And as you say, a number of good bills, Democratic and Republican bills, were left on the cutting room floor as a consequence of this focus on voter ID. So my question to you is, was it worth it in the end? As Speaker, can you look back over what happened during that session and say, yes, it was worth spending as much time on that issue if the result was all these things didn't happen?
Well, Seinfeld's ratings were awfully high, as I recall. So a little
higher than the public's view of the legislature, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no, I think as things turned out, we did very well, and I think people can go home to their districts, and this was one of the goals I had when I became Speaker. Was I wanted to make sure that every member who was elected to the House could go home and at least justify to the people that sent them here, to justify why they did what they did, and to take something home to their districts. And I judge the session based on that criteria more than whether or not the insiders in Austin thought that the calendar was run appropriately on day 124.
But when you go home to your district, because you are, of course, in addition to being Speaker, you do represent District 121, and you've got other members who have to go home to their districts, what do you say was accomplished? What do you tell them, this is what we accomplished during the last session?
Number one, we accomplished a great deal in turning down the heat in the House. I would never have been elected Speaker under normal circumstances. I realize that. Only been there, you know, barely two terms, maybe not even full. But the pressure was so intense and the atmosphere was so negative that job one was just to get back to a more normal routine, to kind of lower the intensity level. And I think we did a very good job of kind of freeing up the atmosphere, making people feel like they could enjoy working in the House again. And I think so. more than, you know, keeping score on how many bills passed or didn't pass, I think the attitude, the environment of the House, the working conditions, the morale, I think we're all greatly improved.
Right, but with all due respect, Mr. Speaker, process doesn't put food on the tables of people in Texas. And so the question is, while it may be from an insider perspective a great thing that the heat was turned down and that the process was smoothed out, from a concrete outcome standpoint, what did the House accomplish that you can point to that you would say this made the lives of Texans, not just people in the legislature, but Texans better?
We accomplished a great deal, I think. We funded priorities, and I think, adequately, I think well. We turned our attention to public education with almost $2 billion more funding there in a difficult budget year. We spent a lot of time on higher education. I think you'll talk to any of the chancellors of the university systems in this state, as I have, and they will each tell you this was the best session for higher education in a generation. So in the tier one process was created, which I think long term is going to have great implications for our state and economic development and higher education. We balanced our budget. We worked out our differences. We left the rainy day fund untouched. I think fiscal conservatives felt pretty good about the way we conducted our affairs. And Democrats were not cut out of the process. So I feel like we accomplished a lot. We also passed a fairly substantial public education reform bill that wasn't always easy to do in the House since I've served there. So I think there's a lot we can point to.
Okay. Well, so you come out of the session ends and the summer happens, and then pretty quickly the attention, not only in Austin but elsewhere, turns away from local matters and to national matters. The Tea Party movement emerges as a force in American politics. The healthcare debate becomes this big contentious battle. Yeah, and so I want to ask about that first. You are not what I would describe as a Tea Party Republican by temperament. Now, you may take issue with that, but I think a lot of people would say that you, it's a pejorative to say this these days, but you are more of a moderate Republican, a moderate conservative more than a Tea Party conservative. Would you agree with that?
Well, you have to tell me what you mean by, what is the Tea Party, what do you mean by Tea Party movement? Do you mean in terms of, do I want to, will I, you know, throw things at a, get up and throw shoes at a you know, town hall meeting? No. But do I share a lot of the concerns that Tea Party organizers have about the direction of the federal government and massive spending and more government control over people's lives? Of course I share that view.
Right.
So I think a lot of times people put the moderate label on me because my personality may be a little lower key than others, but
So you believe from an issue or ideological standpoint, you actually see a certain amount of common ground with
sure.
folks who have emerged in the Tea Party movement.
Yes, what if, and I'm glad they're coming over to the Republican side.
Where were they before?
Well, I'm not sure that some of them were very visible before. I think they're going to help Republicans have a good year in 2010. I certainly hope that's the case.
Well, I want to ask about that because here you have in Texas, as you do elsewhere, a lot of challenges to sitting Republican incumbents from the right, many of them from self-described Tea Party candidates. You know, the Marco Rubio, the candidate for the United States Senate in Florida, was on the cover of the New York Times magazine this weekend. He's become the poster child. He's by no means the only candidate to occupy that wing of the party to challenge a sitting or an establishment, what's perceived to be an establishment Republican. You have, I believe it's 17, Ross counted yesterday, 17 Republican members of the Texas House who have challengers. A number of congressmen, U.S. congressmen from Texas, Republicans have challengers from the right. Is that a good thing? Do you think
Yes, I think it's a good thing. Not that our incumbents are challenged. I'm for every one of the incumbents being reelected, and I believe they will be. But I think having the competition on the Republican side of the primary is a very healthy thing. I hope it increases the turnout, which is going to continue to grow the Republican Party. I don't think that our Republican incumbents have anything to fear on running on their conservative records. But I think the added attention and the activity on our side and the excitement and the enthusiasm that I've seen as I've traveled around the state since June, and I've been everywhere at every corner of the state, the enthusiasm is very much on the Republican side. And if the Tea Party adds to that, so much for the better.
What do you think about the notion of purity testing Republicans. In other words, to some degree, in some of these races, what's happened is that Republicans have been asked a series of questions. Where do you line up on these issues? And if you don't line up 100% on these issues, then we're going to challenge you and potentially throw you out. You've always been, whether or not you accept moderate, you've always been a bigger tent Republican than smaller tent
sure.
Republican.
No, I think if somebody wants to join the Republican Party, I can't imagine anybody wanting to be a Republican if you don't agree on at least 7 or 8 of the 10 leading issues of the day.
Bill Ratliff, Republican, 51% was enough for him, right?
Well, I think that was an exaggeration. He was more than 51%. But I get his point, and I agree with it. It's up to the voters to decide if somebody in a Republican primary or Republican running against a Democrat meets their expectations. But I think too much is made of the purity test. I certainly don't agree that the party should propose one, and to my understanding, they're not.
Well, there was discussion at the national level. The Republican National Committee had 10 principles that they were discussing making where do you fit on this spectrum? And in fact, it was pointed out that Ronald Reagan would have only succeeded on 4 of the 10.
Well, that's a good point. And probably the reason we're not doing that in Texas and putting that card out there for people to respond to. But every campaign's different. Every district is different. The demographics and the attitude of voters is different from place to place. But, you know, I grew up in a family that was very committed to the Republican Party before we started winning elections. And back then, if you wanted to sign up and help in a campaign, nobody asked you what your view was on an election. They said, we're glad to have you. We need a two-party system in this state. And to my knowledge, it was, you know, I think it just goes without saying that 7, 8, 9, 10 out of 10 issues, you're probably going to agree with each other on.
Okay. Let me stay with this notion of the Tea Party emergence and the healthcare debate specifically. Yesterday, you appointed, or there was an announcement that you had appointed a select committee on federal legislation that cited, in particular, the healthcare bill that is now in discussion in Congress. You wanted to monitor how that impacted Texas. Talk a little bit about that, about your view of that, and whether or not you share Governor Perry and General Abbott's views that there may be some constitutional or other legal way, absent other choices, to block what's coming from Washington to Texas.
Well, I don't know what's coming from Washington to Texas, and from what I've, you know, I'm certainly no constitutional scholar, but what I've heard from General Abbott certainly seems to make sense to me, and I find it as offensive as most people do when you read about the process in Washington and the special exceptions made for Nebraska and whatever happened in Louisiana. It just doesn't seem right that a bill that massive that could have the implications that it could have on Texas should be passed in that way. I also think it isn't right that, as I understand it, for the first time the federal government's talking about taxing individuals for not making a purchase of a product. And that seems to me, again, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I think we ought to take a very close look at whether that holds up to constitutional scrutiny or not.
This is a state in which famously it's said, and these aren't Democratic or Republican facts, they're facts, we have more uninsured people than any state in the country. Are you prepared to say to the many uninsured Texans that the system that is in place currently is better than a system that would seek to provide health care to more Texans, or to provide portability of coverage, or to provide, no pre-existing conditions?
Well, I'm not going to defend the status quo, but I certainly don't want to make the situation worse. I don't want to see.
You believe it does?
From what I understand, it looks scary as hell. So I would want to make sure that before we blow up what is maybe not a great system, that we not make it worse, that we not hoist something upon the state of Texas that will encourage doctors to retire from the practice of medicine, that will have unintended consequences, that will drive businesses, you know, berserk. I think that, and into bankruptcy. I think we need to be very careful, and I think there are some alternative approaches that can help in terms of transparency of the medical system. I favor, generally speaking, in almost every situation, a market-based approach to trying to make improvements to a system. And I think that Washington would be well advised to get back to maybe looking at alternatives to what they're trying to push on us. I also think they would be well advised to start reading some of the polls. This is a very unpopular approach they're taking. Anything that has to be pushed through a 60-40 U.S. Senate, or is it 61?
Well, you got to have at least 60 votes. Right, 60. It's complicated.
To get to 60 votes in a strongly left and left-leaning U.S. Senate, if they can barely get that done with these accommodations I talked about in Nebraska and Louisiana, there's something wrong with that plan.
What's the difference between the Senate observing its parliamentary rules to get that passed and the Senate in Texas observing its parliamentary rules or seeking to change them to get voter ID passed? They're the Democrats in the Senate are the majority. Why would they not be in the right to use the parliamentary rules available to them to get that passed?
Well, there weren't special exceptions for certain senatorial districts made. Nobody was exempted from the law that you're talking about, where they suspended the rules in the Senate. And I'm not defending what they did over there, but there wasn't a special deal for Senator X and Senator Y. It was one bill. And in this situation, there were exceptions made for states, which I think is not a good idea and maybe unconstitutional.
Let me ask you about the budget. It is widely assumed, the phrase structural deficit keeps coming up in discussions of the next session. It's widely assumed that we're going to have a deficit of, what, $12 billion, $13 billion? Do you have a sense of the number?
It's a lot of billions. I don't know.
It's a lot of billions. Yeah. So let me ask you about what the state does, can do. First of all, there's apparently a letter that's been circulating. There's discussion of a letter circulating that Governor and Lieutenant Governor signed. I understand you've not signed it.
I have signed it.
You have now signed it. Requesting state agency cuts of a certain amount. Can you talk about the details of what you've asked for?
Yes. This was a concept that was originally raised in November by Governor Dewhurst to take a look now at reducing spending in the current budget by some percentage. I think his initial thought was a modest 2.5%. Take a look at that and see what that produced. We discussed it. I think that's a very smart approach. We know what's ahead of us. Over the weeks during the holidays, I heard from the comptroller, I believe, you know, her view was we're not in a crisis, but it is a situation of serious concern. My view, and I think hers was, let's see what the Christmas sales tax receipts look like. And so over a period of about 6 weeks, we were watching that while we were in discussions with the Lieutenant Governor's office and then later the Governor's office to produce a letter that was signed last week. I'm not sure whether it's been sent or not, but I signed it last week to direct the agency heads to come back to us with a plan in about a period of a few weeks to show us what a 5% reduction in the current budget would look like, making exceptions for public education, for Medicaid, and some of the things that you really can't cut. So it's not a solution to our problem, but it's a good first step.
Is it enough? How much would 5% amount to versus what you expect the overall deficit to be?
It's probably somewhere in the area of $1 billion.
Okay.
So it's significant, but it's not an answer. And to get back to your point about our select committees that we announced yesterday and were appointed yesterday to get to work, one of them, in addition to the committee on federal, to look at the implications of federal legislation on the state, one of the select committees also has been charged with reviewing the fiscal stability situation and to study the structural deficit. Let's get a good handle on where we are. Let's have a full discussion about it because it's going to be with redistricting, I think, the major challenge of next session. So John Otto has been appointed to head that committee, and there's a strong group from Appropriations and Ways and Means and other members to help him with that.
Do you believe that the state ought to, let's say the $1 billion happens, and those cuts will be felt, they'll be hard cuts for the agencies to make, and there'll be effects on people, but make cuts, that's fine. So $1 billion. So now you're looking at maybe
$1 billion out of a $180 billion budget is, it'll be felt, sure, but it's certainly not any more of a sacrifice than a lot of Texas families are having to make in this economy.
Understood, but it also is only a portion of the overall amount that you're going to have to get.
Yes.
So do you drain the rainy day fund in part or in whole? Are there sources of revenue that are on the table that might supplement the cuts that you make?
Well, that's part of the work of this select committee. They'll have to come up with a comprehensive approach, and I think they'll develop every alternative that we think is possible.
Are you in favor of the rainy day fund being drained for this purpose?
No, I'm not in favor of the rainy day fund being drained for any purpose, but it is there for difficult times, and we are in difficult times. The other thing to remember is it doesn't matter whether I want to drain it or not. Two-thirds of the House and Senate have to agree with it. So that's a very high hurdle, and I don't think that we're going to access it to any great degree unless and until we have an overall agreement on other matters that will help balance our budget next session.
Let me ask you about the governor's mansion renovation, which was in the news this weekend again. The plan, apparently, to expand the mansion as part of the renovation. You have a point of view about this?
Yeah, I do. I do have a point of view. I think I'm hearing from my district, from two former members of the Historical Commission who have contacted me with great concerns about the process and about the current plan. I'm not a historic preservationist. I'm not an architectural expert. I don't know a great deal about construction. But I do care about the mansion, and I care about addressing the concerns of people who are experts in that field. And I know there are other House members who would agree with me that we probably ought to slow down and take as we say in the House, back up, members, and take a look at where we are. I attended my first preservation board meeting last week, and I have to tell you, I'm a little uncomfortable with the process there of approving projects years after they've been completed. I would hate to. I would.
Nothing wrong with that. Come on.
I'm sure there are reasons we do it that way, but I would hate to make a big mistake with the governor's mansion, as important a symbolic building as that is.
So you expect that the plan to expand the governor's mansion is going to be on hold?
Well, I would hope that it would be until we have a chance to have everybody's views expressed and thoroughly examine it. I would ask that we put it on hold for a while. We appropriated a lot of money to restore that building, and I think we owe it to the taxpayers of the state and the citizens of the state to get it right.
Okay. Let's do two more things before we do questions. First of all, the person who's going to occupy that mansion, renovated or not. There was a governor's race, you've heard, going on.
I've heard about that, yeah.
You have stayed about a million miles from it, I also understand.
Executive branch politics is of not much interest to
you. No interest to you at all, of course. Is it a good thing for your Republican Party to have these two folks spending $40 million to beat the crap out of each other for the next 6 weeks? Because it's great for the press. I want to say, actually, I like it. But I'm wondering how do you feel about it?
Well, I'm not sure the $40 million part is that healthy. And the beating the crap out of each other isn't all that healthy either. But I think the competition being on our side, as we talked about even with the Tea Party candidates in the primary, I think having the action on our side is another indication that Republicans will have a good year. I think regardless of how the primary turns out in the governor's race, we'll be able to pull together and work for Republican gains in November.
Governor says that the problem with Senator Hutchison is that Washington is this horrible place and that we shouldn't like Washington. You actually worked in two presidential administrations in Washington. Is that right?
I did, yeah.
You know Washington. Is Washington as bad as Governor Perry thinks? Is it the problem?
Well, it wasn't when I was there, but it's been.
Is that the reason?
It's been 15 years since I've been there, or longer, 18 years since I've been there, and it's gotten worse. It's gotten steadily worse. So I think he does have a good point to make.
Is it her fault? Should she be held responsible for what's happening in Washington?
Well, I don't think a Republican senator from Texas should bear responsibility for what he's been critical of. But his point is well made that Washington government has, and politics have increasingly gotten more bitter,
right?
And I think people don't have a very, very fond view of the Congress. But whether you can blame our senior Republican senator from Texas for all of that, that would be a bit of a stretch in my view.
Now she says that the problem is that there's a leadership problem in this state, that the state is run poorly. I'm assuming she's not talking about you. So is she right? Is the governor doing a bad job running the state?
Well, I've worked very well with him, as I have with her. And I think my lack of interest in executive branch politics would best be repeated here.
I wouldn't call that a full-throated endorsement of the governor's leadership.
No, I've worked very well with him. I know that he was probably as surprised as I was that he ended up with me as speaker this session. But we enjoyed our breakfast meetings once a week and with Governor Dewhurst, and I think the three of us worked very well together. So I'm not critical of his leadership. And at the same time, I'm staying the heck away from that race.
But either one, Governor Perry, Senator Hutchison, whoever the nominee is, you will support that person enthusiastically.
My focus is on House races.
Well, that's not a yes, though. I mean, you are going to...
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
will
I mean,
you be
I
out think, campaigning think, for the Republican nominee?
Yeah, I absolutely will. A strong Republican at the top of the ticket this year will help House races down ballot. That's my sole focus is on maintaining and building a Republican majority in the Texas House.
Okay, very quickly before they tell me I'm out of time. Redistricting. We're just going to do redistricting in 10 seconds. Watch.
Yeah,
right. I alluded to the fact that you were elected in February of 2005. That means that you weren't even in the House during the last redistricting fight. But you read about it, I'm sure.
I read a little about it.
Right. What are you going to do to avoid the next redistricting situation turning out the way the last one did?
Well, I think the situation is different to start with. I don't think we're going to have a repeat of where we were. I've been very encouraged by the early conversations that I've had with members of the Texas congressional delegation, with members of the legislature, with members of the redistricting board. I'm encouraged that we're going to have a much better time of it this time. Texas is growing. I expect three or four possibly new congressional seats coming to Texas. The conversations that I've had with the congressional delegation are that they're working well with one another for the most part. So,
what assurances will you give the Democrats that they shouldn't be buying tickets to Ardmore now while they're cheap?
Well, I can't give assurances to anybody because it is redistricting. You're talking about the futures of politicians. I mean, we all have an interest in that. We in the elected class. I know it won't. It's never going to be easy, and I'm not trying to give the impression that it's going to be a slam dunk, no big deal. But I don't think it's going to be as difficult as it was last time. And I do think we'll be able to resolve our differences in a way that's fair. Don't look to me to bend over backwards to help the Democrats, but I'll certainly be fair. I hope that the elections in 2010 are strong for Republicans so that we can continue to elect more Republicans to Congress.
Okay, Mr. Speaker, I want to thank you very much. Our portion of this is now concluded. Appreciate you being
thank you.
Here. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Wet hand. Thank you.
So bad. I didn't look this way right now.
Oh, that's okay.
This has been a conversation with Joe Straus, part of the Texas Tribune's Trib Live event series. The event was made possible by the generosity of our sponsors, AT&T and IBC Bank.